Welcome to the Marlborough Book Festival podcast. We are looking forward to another wonderful weekend from the evening of July 25 through to Sunday, July 28. Dive into the heart of New Zealand's storytelling in beautiful Marlborough. Don't forget to visit our website at marlboroughbookfest.co.nz and sign up for our newsletter. For now, please enjoy this session from the 2023 Marlborough Book Festival.
Welcome everybody to this session of the wonderful Marlborough Book Festival, Seeking the Light. Great to see so many people here, and my name's Laura. I'm from the Cloudy Bay team, so we're delighted to have been part of the festival and have been for a few years now. I think you'll all agree, I'm sure some of you have been to multiple sessions over the weekend. If this is your first session, then you're in for a treat as well, but there's such an amazing and incredible diverse lineup of different authors, speakers, and concepts that you'll hear about. So a really great weekend. We also hope you had a chance to share a glass of wine with us at some point. But yes, I'd like to introduce the Seeking the Light session. So we have Mike White introducing Gavin Lang. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks to Cloudy Bay for sponsoring the session. Amazing support from them. Thanks to the organisers of the festival, and thanks to all you guys for supporting the festival also. Great turnout today for this session, and it's really awesome to see you all. Just quickly, exits out that way. If there's an earthquake, drop cover, hold, and try not to spill your wine. If you haven't already, just turn your phones off or turn them on to silent. And we're going to have questions at the end, like normal. There will be a couple of mics roving. We want you to just wait till the mic arrives and speak into it, so because we're recording the session for the podcasts. And obviously there's an opportunity to buy Gavin's wonderful book, Seeking the Light, afterwards out in the foyer. Gavin's a Wanaka mountain guide and adventure photographer, and probably one of the most experienced people when it comes to climbing in the Southern Alps. Seeking the Light is about his climbing the 24 highest peaks in the Southern Alps and in the country, but it's illustrated with utterly stunning and sometimes completely unbelievable photos. But the book's about a whole lot more than that. It's a meditation on the healing power of nature and on the importance of getting into the outdoors. Gavin's just returned from Peru, where he's been climbing, which is an explanation for his healthy tan in the middle of winter. So can you please join me in welcoming Gavin to Marlborough and this festival?
Thank you.
The peaks of the Southern Alps, Gavin, are a long way from Dublin, where you grew up. Tell me about that upbringing and your first kind of brushes with nature.
Well, that's right. I'm not from these parts, hence the dodgy accent. I grew up in Dublin, and I didn't come from a particularly outdoor family. There wasn't tramping or visits into nature, but the exploration was definitely there, and I talk about this in the book. For me, venturing off into the fields or the woods behind our house was everything. That was my world expanding. And it wasn't until maybe about 15, I went on a school trip. We did some rock climbing, we did some hill walking, and I noticed I was in that group of people who were in a minority, but the ones who were really enjoying it, you know. What's the problem? Why is everybody complaining about this? It's not hard. We're just climbing up, or we're just hanging off a cliff face. Whatever. Who cares? This is fun. But it wasn't until I moved to Belgium as a 17-year-old I tried to pursue I pursued a musical career.
You're a drummer.
It wasn't successful, that's all. I didn't become the rock star. I grew up at Cedarwood Close, just around the corner from Bono. So it was quite a delight to see my book and Bono's book on the same shelf at Whitcools and Paper Plus. But one of them became a famous rock star.
And one became a famous rock climber.
I don't know about that. World famous in Wanaka, maybe.
Yep.
Yeah. So where was I? Belgium. I started caving when I was in Belgium. and absolutely fell in love with that. It was fantastic. Going down deep, dark holes that are damp and dank and horrible and tight squeezes, absolutely loved it. But just had this feeling of going above ground is just that much more interesting, and always felt like mountaineering was something I would one day try. And it wasn't till I came to New Zealand that I got to scratch that itch.
So how did New Zealand come onto your radar from living in Belgium, and how did you end up here for the first time?
One thing leads to another. When I lived in Belgium, everyone spoke English, but after speaking pidgin English for 2 years, I decided it was the time to learn to speak Dutch or Flemish. And so with that language, I was fluent by the time I left. I went back to Ireland and I started working in a call center for an airline. And United Airlines flew to New Zealand, the furthest place on the planet that I had on my wish list. So it was time to pay a visit. And February 2000, my life changed.
So tell us about that and about that first visit, which was just a holiday, wasn't it?
It was a three-week holiday. It was a big into caving, but I went with a friend from Belgium. We said, we won't do any caving. There isn't enough time for it. We'll go and do all the touristy stuff. The last thing I did was Franz Josef, a guided tour on the Franz Josef Glacier, and then headed home and said, oh my God, awestruck, completely awestruck. I need to go back. So I planned my escape, and about a year and a half later, I came back for a year. And then, well, after the year, I won't go into detail about what happened, but it was a massive adventure. I went home, and for the first time in my life, I was homesick. But it was for New Zealand. I was never homesick for Ireland, but something connected here. Everything about the country, the landscape, the people, the mentality, the way of life, the freedom, the space, blue skies, lack of pollution, whatever it is. I was hooked, and it was a low point back in Ireland, trying to find a way back to New Zealand.
But you came here and you did a course, an outdoor course at Araki Polytech in Timaru, and that led you to the mountains.
Yes.
Literally, and to the west coast and the glaciers again.
That was the gateway to, at the very least, worst case scenario, I'll have a really good, fun year in New Zealand. Because I've exhausted my work travel visa. I've worked that work and holiday visa. I've exhausted that. I was collecting visas for New Zealand at this point. Now I was on to study visa. I will study outdoor recreation leadership. And the cunning plan was maybe I could get a job on the glacier, because they need a lot of glacier guides. So the threshold is quite low. They'll let me in. I'll get a visa with them, and then I can start my mountaineering apprenticeship proper. Mm. And
that's which, what happened. Which you did, and you threw yourself into it utterly and totally, with some eventual effects that, you know, you didn't foresee, didn't want. Just quickly tell us about that, what you did to your body.
I followed the dream to become a mountain guide, starting with the glacier guiding. And they say if you find something or you do something you love, you'll never work a day in your life. Okay, fantastic. But you can't overdo it. And I did. I never took days off. I never took rests. My days off were, I'll go for an easy rock climb. I'll fill it with another couple of mountain trips. So there's a little undercurrent of addiction going on in this book. You know, it's not just pretty pictures. There is a deeper story about addiction overcoming the injury when my body said, enough is enough. You know, it manifested in my neck with three herniated discs. And that constant chronic low-level pain was absolutely debilitating.
Did you ever fear that you wouldn't get back in the mountains? You'd been smitten with the mountains. You had seen your future lying in the mountains, and here your potential career was in tatters. Did you really fear that you wouldn't get back there?
I didn't know if I'd walk without, or just live or sleep without pain. Driving was super painful. Sitting in a chair like this was super painful. What? I couldn't get my neck in a comfortable position. So mountaineering was way you know. But the whole persona I had built for myself out of being young, fit, and unstoppable, that all crumbled. And that is the fantastic lesson that came from it. It's the pain and suffering that came from that and the deep hole that I went into, I would not wish on anybody else. But I'm so glad I chanced upon it because it woke me up.
And you climbed out of it. Very quickly, just tell the audience how you managed to get from that deep, dark hole to the peaks of the Southern Alps.
Well, it wasn't very quick. Very quickly, it wasn't very quick. A lot of soul searching, and in combination with physical therapy. Some physical therapies didn't work. Some did. I won't prescribe any magical recovery system, but I will say meditation was a fantastic, and yoga was a fantastic way to climb out of that hole. And they work so well on the physical and mental level. I couldn't have done it without both of those. Cool. So I managed to avoid an operation.
Calm and peace, that was important in your life. And I'll just get you to bring to read a little passage from this book. It's the start of Gavin's book, and we won't say who it's by or anything about it until afterwards, but can you just read this for us, Gavin?
What then do I mean tonight by the healing power of nature? I mean to refer to the way in which nature ministers to our minds, all more or less diseased by the Russian racket of civilization, and helps to steady and enrich our lives. My first point is that there are deeply rooted, old established, far-reaching relations between man and nature which we cannot ignore without loss. There would be less psychopathology of everyday life if we kept up our acquaintance. We have put ourselves beyond a very potent phys medicatrix if we cease to be able to wonder at the grandeur of the star-strewn sky, the mystery of the mountains, the sea eternally new, the way of the eagle in the air, the meanest flower that blows, and the look in a dog's eye. And that's quite an emotional thing to read.
Yeah, it is.
You know, I've read it a million times, and it's so powerful.
And it struck me. And just for the audience, that was written in 1914 by Professor J. Arthur Thompson at a British Medical Association lecture. World War One had just broken out, and he was talking about the Russian racket of civilization. It's something that's even more pertinent, or just as pertinent now. It's something that you've thought about a lot, and the importance of nature, getting out into nature. Life's becoming busier, isn't it? We're becoming more urbanized. So how crucial is it that we kind of preserve and use our rural and wild spaces?
I did so much research to prove what I could feel about this connection with nature. So coming out of this injury, I realized that the deeper purpose behind me mountain guiding or facilitating people's journey in the mountains was to also tap into what was going on in their lives and maybe unpack the stresses and get them to notice the connection that they have with nature and how at the start of the trip they would start with these stresses, and by the end, lo and behold, there would be more of a flow in their lives. So my purpose changed. How important is it for us to, I can't stress how important it is for us to have a nature connection every day, no matter how small. Not all of us are mobile. I won't be mobile forever. I'm a realist, you know. But having a connection with nature, doing the gardening bare feet, whatever it is, it's so important for us. And it's proven in science.
So, I mean, we often, nature plays second fiddle sometimes to progress. And progress is seen as vital, and growth is a must. But they're not always necessarily positive, are they?
No. That's an easy question, isn't it? That's an easy one to answer. Let's solve all the political problems in answering that right now.
Yeah, we've got 45 minutes.
Okay. Or we're missing 15. Okay. Well, let me see. Let me summarize. I can see both sides of the, you know, status quo or progress stagnation argument. I can definitely see both things that are going on. But if I relate it to something more local, I don't know if any of you are aware of the desire to build another airport in Wanaka, where I'm based, and it's quite a controversial issue. There's two options, and what's absolutely clear to me is that we can't build an airport and then figure out the rest. There has to be, it's too fast. So I'm not saying there shouldn't be an airport, I'm not saying there should be an airport, but progress, if it's too fast, we don't fill in the gaps. So where's the planning? You know, someone has money for an airport because they want to make money, and that's great, that's progress, cool. But what about all the stuff in between? We've already got a great example of what kind of a cluster goes on in Queenstown. And they've had an airport for how many years? As long as Queenstown has existed. So we need to plan. Absolutely need to plan.
And we need to preserve the mountains. So let's talk about the mountains. And let's talk about, I mean, life's tough already. Life's hard. And yet you add to that by going into the mountains, going into a place where there's danger and discomfort.
Yeah.
So let's talk about death then. Okay. I mean, how do you deal with that ever-present possibility every time you go into the mountains?
Yeah.
And let's bring up a couple of photos of some of the places that you put yourself in.
Yeah, this book has got little meditations on death as well.
Yeah.
And it would be wrong of me to write it without touching on the subject of death.
Let's go to the ones. Yeah, here's an example. Okay, these are the kind of positions you put yourself in,
yeah.
And don't tell me that it doesn't cross your mind one false step and history.
Absolutely. So it. How can I say this? Death. As a companion, helps to keep us alive. There's many different ways I can explain that, but if we let death overwhelm us, we're just riddled with fear. This is useful in the mountains. This is as useful in the mountains as it is in daily life. So to embrace it as something that's inevitable, it's inevitable. It's very hard to grasp, and emotionally, we put up barriers against that. But if we accept it as something that's inevitable, we can actually live more full lives. So just to add to that, I have a fear of heights. I have a fear of small spaces. I have a fear of cold water. And so my life has been about doing it the hard way, about leaning into those things to see what they teach me. You know, I'm looking for the lessons, and you know, I've overcome. I don't think about heights all that much, but when I do, I'm like, there's a little person watching me from the outside saying, "What are you doing? How can you do this?" And for some reason, the heart rate's still okay and all that. But I remember the early days of hanging on a rope, trusting this 10 mil rope. It's as thick as your finger. Hanging on this thing, going, oh my God, I am so scared. And same goes for caving. But I get sweaty palms when I think back to some of the things that I did caving, some of the squeezes I went through. Some of the squeezes I went through that I got bruised ribs from. Breathe out and then move. Yeah. And more recently, while I was writing this book, one of the things that kept me grounded was cold water immersion. Yet another exploration into how much pain and suffering I could put myself under. But that's an easy one because it's 3 minutes or 4 minutes or whatever. And it gave me insight into how the breath works on another level. I mean, these are all the little free pieces of gold that are available for us to pick up as we go through life.
So we can either run away from the things we're scared of or confront them and deal with them and learn from them.
Absolutely. Yeah. We have to lean into the wind or we don't grow strong. You know, I elaborate on that in the book, this story about the biosphere 2 and stress wood. If you'll allow me, in Arizona in the 90s, there was a group of scientists who set up biosphere 2. Biosphere 1 is the Earth. And they decided to lock themselves away, 8 scientists, lock themselves away, be completely self-sustaining. And they hit some roadblocks, but they also made some amazing discoveries. They grew plants really fast with their recycled earth and so on. But what was happening to the trees was they grow extra fast and then fall over. Why? Because there's no wind. We have to position ourselves into the wind or we don't grow strong. So choose your discomfort. You know?
Yeah, there's discomfort and then there's real danger. And I wonder how... how much your attitude to real danger and about mortality and these things has changed since you had a partner, Jin?
Yeah.
And you had a daughter, Violet. Let's bring up the picture of Violet.
This is our lockdown antics. There we go. So I've only got one daughter. This is one of the things we did to just stay sane. Everybody remembers what they did during lockdown. Or not. This is one of the things we did. And my goal was to get out every day into nature somehow and be creative and play games and all the rest of it. But I think back to you, the question you were posing was, has anything changed with having a partner and having a daughter? And absolutely, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I'm phasing into retirement.
I mean, are Jin and Violet now the best motivations for coming home safely?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thinking back to the injury, I didn't have a partner then, but it felt like I learned what my values were and you know, what's left when I can't see myself as this persona, or I can't project myself as this strong mountaineer type who is unstoppable. What's left? What are my values? Because it's not built around all of that. That will change. What's left? What truly transcends all of that? And it's this family values and strong connection and relationships, amongst other things. So, and then Jin showed up a couple of years after that injury. And I was ready for her. She was definitely ready for me because she's a woman. She gets to decide and all that sort of stuff. You know about that.
Yeah, I know. After each trip into the mountains, you turn around, you look at them and you say thank you. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, it's gratitude. It's a ritual of sorts. I'm not a religious person. But it is definitely a kind of, you know, it's a Hail Mary. It's a reminder that they've granted me safe passage. So that comes up. It's a thank you for granting me safe passage, amongst other things. And I also let my clients know, and I haven't had one single client object to joining in. It always works. It's a really important thing, just going to bed. What am I grateful for today? I don't do it every day. I'm no saint. But it's very useful. Mm. It's just a reminder.
You mentioned the clients, and this struck me. I mean, everyone that goes into the mountains, there's risk involved. But you're doubling that because you are responsible for your client. This is someone who's paying you to guide them up a peak or somewhere. And so how heavily does that weigh on you that you've got to bring not just yourself home, but them home to their families?
How heavily does it weigh on me? It's a different kind of stress to going climbing with a friend. There's definitely an element of just trusting this person's competent and capable, and I can see it happening. But generally, if a client comes to me, My rule now is if they've asked to be guided, it's because they need guiding. In terms of the stress, I don't feel it until I stop. It's odd. It just feels like my calling. So it doesn't feel like a burden. And it's very different. It's a different mindset, very different mindset. Just calculating slopes. Is this something I can manage a client over? It's very different. And that is what makes it interesting. Otherwise, I'd stop. You know, the average person can't climb Mount Cook, Mount Aspiring, or whatever their objective is, but they might be able to with my help. Sure. And I have the sort of means to help them there. That's what I get a kick out of.
But you're also conscious of them and their families. And sometimes you actually do talk to the families before or after you've come back from a trip.
Yep. They might bring their family down. They might do a trip as part of a family holiday and integrate it. Many of my clients are repeat clients, come multiple times, and then I might meet the family on the second or third trip. And I like that because I'm not just responsible to them. I'm responsible to their family. And let's not forget that it's the family that will sue me. It's not them who's dead that might sue me. That's not the problem. They signed the waiver, that's cool, but the family are out for my blood. Yeah. So it helps to have a little relationship there already.
So
that they don't think I'm...
Gavin Lang, the most cunning climber in New Zealand.
You know my secret.
Look... along with the moments of fear and danger, you talk about moments of absolute perfect clarity in the mountains, of being in the moment of bliss, of almost moments of enlightenment. Do you want to bring up the Carolyn Face photo for this one? And how real and fleeting are these moments for you in the mountains?
This is a great example because... I climbed the Caroline Face not for the book, and I write about my motivations.
This is Caroline Face of Mount Cook.
Caroline Face of Mount Cook, the southeastern side. I write about my motivations for not climbing it again for the book. It was a one-off. It was a solo, unroped, nobody else involved, full meditation on the mountain. But what happened was... early in the climb, my concern was for something falling on me. And I got through halfway, got through the crux, which is halfway, the steepest part. Navigated that after almost turning back. Got within 100 meters of the summit. And I was in this complete flow state, absolutely in tune with nature, myself, the mountain, the whole lot, everything just ticking along nicely. It was a bubble of... energy moving upwards, and then some ice fell and it smacked me in the hand and everything changed. Flow state was gone. That's how fleeting it is. Mm-hmm. Now, if it had been bigger, of course, it could have knocked me off. But to answer your question, the flow state can evaporate very quickly.
Yeah. I mean, you say that mountaineering is great for your heart and soul, but sometimes the mountains surely... must break your heart and be soul-destroying when you don't reach your summit, when you don't do what you set out to do. How do you deal with that?
I don't have that much of a connection, and I think it's less and less as I get older with grabbing the summit. Honestly feel like it's the adventure that happens along the way. Early on... tagging summits is important because it's a milestone. There's no two ways about it. Get to the top, you turn around. And there's some renewed energy in there that comes from actually reaching the top. But more often than not now, once I've climbed the route, whatever the route is, the more technical, challenging part, I might turn around and not even bother going to the summit. No, that's enough. Let's go. We're out of there. So choose your challenge.
It's the journey, not the destination kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't feel there's any heartbreak in that.
Yeah. And it's not like conquering the mountain, this whole idea.
No, the best you can hope for is a draw.
Yeah. Let's get to the heart of the matter. You take avocados when you're climbing mountains like this. Can you just explain that?
Everybody has their own quirky diets. I do take a lot of freeze-dried food and, you know, lightweight stuff, particularly in the campaign for this, because I wanted to go as light as possible so I could still carry 2 kilos of camera gear, right? And there was one thing I just didn't want to make any compromises about, and that was avocados. Mm-hmm. So I took 4 avocados across the top of Mount Cook. And, of course, I handpicked them a certain way, but back in town they ripen properly, and they don't ripen on the top of a mountain. So
funny that.
Oh. So I carried one for 4 days and then actually opened it and went, oh, it's rubber. Damn.
Somewhere
but
on the
avocados are, well, I don't know what it is. I just they tune me up quite nicely. They grease my wheels. There's the right fat in there or something. I don't know. It works.
Look, obviously mountaineering is uncomfortable. And that's something that some of your clients don't seem to always get. They have this romantic notion about ascending peaks and the, you know, the great days of alpinism without comprehending what it takes to get there. You find that sometimes. Let's bring up the trench foot photo. So.
Oh, yeah. Was that back? I actually find armchair mountaineering very comfortable.
Yeah.
yeah. This.
So what's this?
This is me mansplaining my way to the top of a mountain.
Yeah.
This is trench foot, which the name comes, I believe, from the First World War.
Yeah, I think so.
Soldiers would have wet feet for days and would have to do marches. And, of course, once your soggy fingers or feet are wet, they're very tender. That skin is very tender, and those crevices get deeper and deeper. It feels like razor blades. And this was on Sefton, which is 95% tramping. Mount Sefton has a little bit of snow and ice at the top. And, it, you know, it's a serious mountain because of the sheer size of it. But you start out in the West Coast Valley, and the grass is dewy and wet, and so your socks get wet and your feet get wet. And so a whole day bouncing around. And by the end of the day, I've got these deep crevices in my feet there. And this, once they dry out, turns to blisters. And the rest is bright pink. Looks like someone took to my foot with a belt sander or a planer. And it's very painful.
And you talk about that in the book of, you know, walking on razors all the way out to the...
It makes a good story.
and you do it again, you know.
These books don't fill themselves. You need to,
But your clients, I mean, your experience.
If I can add,
my
goal was not to have any carnage on the trip. Even though, at the back of my mind, if someone falls off or I witness something or, you know, I lose a foot or something like that, this will make a great story. This book will be a bestseller. But the goal was to stay safe, come home safely, and not have any carnage. So this is the best I could do. Trench foot.
Yeah. Well, there's a good mix of kind of bliss state and semi-carnage in there. So, you know, people will understand everything that you go through. But, I mean, for the punters, that, like I say, they're coming off the street, they have this romantic idea of getting up a mountain, and then what happens sometimes to them?
Oh, they get blisters. Oh, yeah. So I do get a lot of... No, I won't say a lot. I get some clients who have read classic books, Annapurna or stuff where there's loads of carnage. There's death everywhere. And they're signing up for this and I want to go there. And it's like day one, there's a bit of pack rubbish on the back of their hip here. It's really sore. I don't know if I can carry on. Okay. Well, we're not going to get a bestseller out of you then.
But, I mean, discomfort and suffering are some, you know, if we look at them as something to be avoided, we won't build resilience, like you were saying, to the inevitable adversities of life. Do you fear that in society we've perhaps become too comfortable, too safe in our lives?
I think so. Does anybody disagree? You know.
As they sit there in their chairs with their glass of cloudy.
Does anybody work? Does anybody represent WorkSafe here? No, am I free to speak? We want guarantees. We want insurances, don't we? We do. We do. We got this White Island thing going on right now, and every single one of these things that happens in the adventure tourism world just makes it harder to operate adventures where you might get hurt or you might die. Heaven forbid you might learn something. It is sad. It's sad to see that happening. I say this to my clients all the time. There's two things. If they were invented today, they'd be illegal. One is mountain guiding, and the other is ladders. Ladders. I've hurt myself twice on ladders. This finger doesn't work properly anymore because of a ladder injury. Ladders. I'm so scared of ladders. That's my next book. I do think we're missing out, even sanitizing playgrounds into submission. Why do we need to pour this rubber mat stuff all over the place? What is it? Cost $250,000. And what do we get? A slide and a swing. Great. That's great for children's creativity. And, you know, I could go on and on that topic. A better man to read is Richard Louv, Last Child in the Woods. Has anybody read that book? Yeah, it's a fantastic book. I mean, I use that as a reference for this book. Our children are not going to know how to navigate life without seeing some kind of, without falling over. You know, how does a wound heal? Wounds don't happen because you're wrapped in cotton wool. What are you learning? So, yeah, I'm a big fan of sending my child to a school where they play in the dirt. Kindergarten, preschool, whatever it's called, where they've got lots of outdoor space, that they have an outdoor adventure program. And that's my little fight back against the regulation that's just squashing us.
Yeah,
it's pretty soon, I won't be surprised if mountain guiding, it doesn't exist anymore because it's just unfeasible. It's no longer affordable for the companies to get through the regulations and the audits and the concessions and all the rest. And it's no longer affordable for the clients. Mm. It'll always be affordable for someone, but, you know, is it just for the elite? It would be great to see it available just to the layman and not someone who's highly successful in business with lots of money to throw around.
Let's talk about the photography side of things, because you're a rare beast in that respect. Not just are you one of the country's top climbers, but you're an incredible photographer as well, and bring images of these places that are inaccessible to most of us into our living rooms via your book, etc. So can you just talk us through a little bit about the practicalities of that, or how you got into being a photographer as well as a mountaineer, and the practicalities every time you go out? And let's just maybe flick through a few of these photos that we've got.
It is working. A little bit of astrophotography. I'm not the most patient photographer in the world, especially after a long day on the mountain, but somehow dragged myself out of the hut after having dinner. I was like, I should go to bed. It's really late, but oh my God, look at that Milky Way, you know? And it doesn't come up. It's just a couple of months of the year where there's no moon interference and all that sort of stuff. So I'm going to grow into the retirement. I will grow into a more patient photographer, I reckon, because I'll have time and I won't be moving so fast. And this is a favorite shot. We just landed on it.
Just explain this one, where you're standing.
I'm standing on the summit of Mount Tasman, looking along the North Ridge. And Rory McFarlane is down climbing. He's not coming towards me, he's going down. It's the middle of winter, where the 23rd of June, that was 2020, the sun has just gone down. That's the last of the light. The sun's just dipped below the horizon. It's cold. because it's the middle of winter. It's pretty serious. This says to me, things are getting pretty serious now. You've still got to get home. Most of it will be in the dark. Conditions are spicy. The soft snow over very hard ice. And that may not sound like spicy conditions, but it is. It's very hard to get your axe in through the soft snow into the ice. And we're concentrated. We're focused. But this is a favorite trip because, and a favorite photo, for so many reasons. This is the death chapter, but particularly because it was Rory and I. It was our third trip together, and we were not only in a flow state for ourselves, but for each other. We were finishing each other's sentences, and it's amazing. It's like speed dating. It's amazing how quickly you can grow bonds with people when your life is on the line. I think previously this might have happened in the wartime. In our case, we weren't fighting a mountain or anything like that. We were just hoping for the draw. But our lives were on the line and we were looking after each other. Even though we're not tethered together, we're not roped together, we are climbing unroped. We're thinking the same things about the snow stability and the concerns that we have. And Rory's actually started to get... I started out the day feeling sick, sore throat, wasn't sure if it was going to happen. And I started to come around, and then Rory started to fade. He hadn't been up to 3,500 meters for 5 or 6 months. And he started to feel the effects of altitude. I started to sort of wobble a bit, and then I took over. So there was this real kinship and camaraderie going on that trip.
Cool. Flick through a couple more quickly before.
Aspiring?
Aspiring's your mountain, isn't it?
Yeah, called Tititia Te Maunga. Yeah, it's kind of odd for the white man from Ireland to say something like that, but honestly feel and have felt this very strong connection with Aspiring. It was, I've witnessed death on that mountain. I've been party to rescues on the mountain. I've climbed it more than any other mountain in New Zealand, apart from Mount Iron. of the 3,000ers. I know it well. It never bores me. It's amazing how some mountains can become a little bit boring, the same path, but it seems like it's always got these little, variations for me. There's something about it. I'm drawn to it, and I've leaned into that, and I understand it better now. It's like it keeps calling me back.
Flick another one.
And we had three goes to get the photographs that I want. We turned around this day because the wind is so strong. You can see a snow plume at the top of the mountain. We'd climbed a new route up the south face, the face off to the side here. And Suji, who I was climbing with, we carried on for about an hour and turned around. The wind was too strong and we had to go back for another try. Different party. That didn't work either. So went back again. So there was, you don't see this in the book. You don't see the half dozen or more trips that didn't happen. But Aspiring was three rounds. The Ayers Ridge on between Haydinger and Douglas, two mountains on the main divide. This is Pat Gray, who accompanied me on the last four summits, I think. Again, speed dating. I'd seen him in the hills. I barely knew him. I called someone else the 11th hour, just before this trip. And they said, oh, no, I'm not available, but Pat is. Oh, yeah, Pat. Yeah, I've seen him on Mount Cook. I've seen him do a grand traverse of Mount Cook and come back smiling. He seems like the right kind of guy. So, and it worked out, I never had any duds. I never had anybody like, oh, my God, what am I doing with this person? Mm. It always worked out.
Mm. Hey, can we go back to the image that's the cover of the book, because it's
that one.
No, that one. I mean, that's describe this, because we look at this and we think,
I just wanted to check. go.
Oh, Gavin must say to his climbing partner, hey, can you just run up to that peak there and I'll wait
looks
here.
Looks windswept and interesting. Yeah.
It doesn't work like that. You say that you actually, it's pretty natural. There's, you know, not much posing that goes on.
Yeah, I make it very clear to them, I want you to wear bright colours. Alistair wasn't wearing bright colours that day, but his silhouette worked quite well. I then started to hand people jackets. Wear this red jacket, wear this orange jacket. But otherwise, I don't want to interfere with the people I'm climbing with. I either run ahead or I hold back. Whatever I think I can frame as a good photograph. And that was the case here. Alistair had just been behind me, and I let him walk away. And I shot some video, and I shot some panoramas, and then he ended up just standing and hanging out on the summit. And I said, oh, this is cool. And so I try not to interfere. I let people do their thing. The closest thing I would say to stop is just slow it down, because I'm getting my camera organized. It's always on the front, ready to roll. So what you're seeing is the leftovers from a lot of missed opportunities. The book could have been even better if I'd stopped people. But we went climbing and the days were long enough.
Hey, we just want to wrap up this section before we get into questions. There's a wonderful passage at the end of Gavin's book, which I can't recommend highly enough. Just an amazing book that you can keep going back to time and time again and getting new stuff from. But there's Gavin kind of finishes by, it's a monologue in the book about where he's asking himself about why he does it and what's important. And so I'm sort of going to read the questions that he's asking himself, and these are the answers that Gavin comes up with. So why do I put myself through this time and time again?
Because it mostly feels good.
But is that what life's about?
No. Well, life is about more than feeling good.
Like what?
Well, occasionally life is about giving back or being of service, but I have no definitive answer. I can only be sure that life is far better if I seek out a way of making it more purposeful.
Life's more purposeful if I expose myself to dangers? What?
Exposing myself to danger and taking calculated risks makes me feel more alive. It helps me face fear, doubt, anxiety, and explore them in a calculated way. There's nothing more rewarding than observing challenges arising in the mind. The reward goes far beyond the thrill of a mountain ascent.
You sound like a preacher.
Well, you choose your own challenge. It's not the effort, the jostle with death, or the trophy climbs, but the sense of humility, respect and gratitude a journey has given us. It matters not how you got there, but that is how I'm getting there.
Why don't you just stay at home and stay safe? Promise me this is your last trip.
No promises. When I've done my piece, I'll kick back in the rocking chair and reminisce.
Just give up now. I can see how you're relabeling mountaineering as the pursuit of high ideals. You're just a con artist.
I'm not selling anything. I've just been lucky to realize that the mountain environment is a trigger for deeper reflection. You'll inevitably find pain and suffering in your life, so choose your own flavor. Try something that takes you out of your comfort zone.
Cool. Thanks, Gavin. Hey, so we've got some time for questions. As I say, we've got two roving mics. Can you put your hand up and then just wait till the mic arrives with you, because we are recording this session for the podcast. So, questions, please. Gentleman here in the middle, can you get a mic to him? Just wait till you get the mic.
Could you please describe to us your camera gear, bearing in mind that weight is always an issue?
Sure. And I, just for you and the camera enthusiasts, I wrote a small chapter called The Tools of the Trade. Robbie Burton, the publisher, thought it would be a great idea. I thought maybe somebody would be interested. He thought it was a great idea to put it in there. So I've customized some things and cut straps off and made it so that I can drop the camera if I need to. Never had to drop the camera, but, you know, belaying is definitely more important than taking photographs. Going with one lens is really important. The camera lens and body, it is a full-frame camera, so reasonably heavy when you include all the batteries. The Sony A7 III is what I used for this whole project. And then I would make a decision going out the door. Will I take this lens or that lens and go with it? Because taking two lenses, I never swapped the monocline. That's too much. It's just too much. You introduce dust and all that kind of stuff. So it's a very simple setup, a lightweight carbon fiber tripod if I was hut-based, so if I flew into a hut. Otherwise, a tiny little tripod, I think, was worth $30. Super solid, but I'd get it would allow me to put it in the right position, and then I would prop up the lens with a rock or a rope or something like that. So there's always ways to improvise. But everything always hung on the front of my pack. It came off if we reached a certain grade. I could always gauge how hard a climb was if I couldn't, just go unroped. And the next gauge then was, is the camera coming off because it's too steep? And so on some occasions, I would like to have had a smaller camera, but I dragged the big camera up absolutely everything. All the details are in there. I think if you haven't got a book with your name on it yet, you should go and see Calvin on the way out of here.
Just to mention that Gavin had his camera nicked a few days ago on his way back from climbing in Peru, stolen on a bus. So someone's enjoying that in Peru at the moment, and we're just going to have a pass a hat round probably afterwards. So yeah,
you can cry into it. You don't need to put money in it.
Other questions for Gavin?
Thanks very much. That was a really fascinating talk and discussion. There is a term that's been coined, and I don't remember who coined it, but they talk about the comfort crisis, and they discuss how that actually affects our well-being. And so finishing up with the comments that you were making about why don't you just stay at home, because aspects of well-being could be detrimental for you, it sounds like. I'm curious to know how many days duration your trips are, and if you could just talk a little bit more about maybe some of the psychological planning, if anything, and a bit more about how you prepare and also, I guess, how you decompress when you come back.
The psychological crisis?
No,
what was it called?
Psychological aspect, because there's the physical training.
Yeah, what was the name of the crisis, though? I'd never heard of it.
The crisis is the comfort crisis.
Comfort crisis, yeah. Nice term. Okay. My trips are usually objective driven, so 3 to 4 days for my trips, for personal trips. Some of these, like the walk-in, walk-out trips, were 7 days long. With clients, it's usually a minimum of 5, because we need a day to get established and I need a day to get out. And then 3 in the middle seems to be the sweet spot, but about 7 days is what I aim for. Yeah, I've done longer trips, but that would be the average. And the second part of your question, the psychological, that's a hard one. There was something that I developed for the book. It didn't appear in the book, but I call it the pose triangle. And P is planning, E is enthusiasm, S is skill, and O is the objective. So you need to have this balance. In the early days, it tends to be lots of enthusiasm, not so much skill, and depending on your style, it could be lots of planning or none at all. You just kind of let it happen. You just flow into it. But those are three important aspects. I feel like the thing that I'm lacking in now is enthusiasm until I actually get into the mountains, because 4 out of 5 trips don't happen because of the weather. And then, so show me the weather forecast and I will fit the trip in. And then I will find a partner and then I will start planning and pack a bag. And I actually kind of hate packing now. Done it so many times. But it's easy. And then suddenly I get into the mountains and then I change. Then the enthusiasm appears And I'm hoping after doing it for 20 odd years now that the skill is high enough, and I tap into that. So that's a psychological process, I suppose, that I've realized happens. But that pose triangle, those are my words, but I've actually noticed this occurring in two different places. One was in a business strategy mindset type book. I went, actually, he's just using different words. It's the same thing. So, nature spoke to me in a different way. The universe spoke to me in a different way, using different words. But, this wasn't a guidebook. This wasn't a technical manual about how to climb. So we left it out of there.
Over here.
Great question, by the way.
Yeah, it was.
You mentioned a few times in your talk and illustrated on Mount Tasman that you might prefer to climb unroped. Is there any practical reason behind that? And I presume your climbing partners feel the same?
It's faster. Mm. Let's not forget that we're there to climb. And the belay is to catch us in the event that something goes wrong. Where steep rock climbing, for example, it makes complete sense. A single pitch climb, you put a rope on, you catch the fall if anything happens. The mountains just, we need a 15-kilometer rope to belay, And stopping to belay every single pitch, if it's just moderate in difficulty, is just unfeasible. So there's a certain point. What was Dave Vass's book, Not Set in Stone? He had a fantastic one-liner, I hope I can remember, something along the lines of mountaineering is about dilemmas accepted and then forgotten. It's a different world in the high mountains where you get to the point where you say, I can't give a belay, I can't take a belay, or it's just not going to happen. We're only going to get like 5% of the way out of the hut. So you're accepting and then leaning into your skill to stay on the mountain. When it gets ultra steep and you need a belay, then you take a belay. So it's a calculated risk.
And Gavin actually has a little section at the front of this book which is like a disclaimer saying, essentially, don't try this at home. Look, thank you so much, everybody, for coming along to this session. Fabulous to hear you, Gavin. Thanks for coming up from Wanaka, come back from Peru first, to talk with us. Gavin's going to be out in the foyer selling Seeking the Light. It is an amazing book. It's a special book. And thanks for writing it. Thanks for climbing up 24 peaks and the stories behind it. So thanks again.
Thank you.
And join with me in thanking Gavin.
Thank you. Thanks, Mike.
So you better scarp.
You better scarp out there and sign some books.
Good job.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
It's awesome.
Cheers.